It's my pleasure to welcome all of you, hey Larry, to 2011 Spring Institute for Lived Theology. My name is Charles Marsh, and I'm the director of the Project on Lived Theology. I guess this is our fifth or sixth SILT, and I have to say it's one that I'm terribly excited about. You have no idea how gratifying it is to look at the schedule and to see so many former University of Virginia students who are now in well into their brilliant careers and who are inspirations to me, and I hope in some respects they become conversation partners with you here as grad students and recent PhDs. I hope all of you have a copy of the schedule. We're going to try to move along more or less on schedule, and hopefully we'll sort of move into a kind of collaborative spirit. And I do want this whole day and a half to have a sort of an informal feel, even though there are papers and sessions and the like. I think it may be helpful, just before I offer a few remarks, to just make a few introductions. And I would like to ask the members of the SILT program, the speakers, if you would just introduce yourself, and then we'll have grad students say, you know, where they're from and what they're up to. So right here, Pete. And Pete is the author of this wonderful sort of ethnographic theological work, and sometime you can ask him about how he came to be nominated for a Grammy Award. Okay, Gillian. It's true though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, Gillian. No, that's enough, Gillian. Go, please, go for it. Excellent.
One of the last kids, I'm a professor of religion at the University of Florida, where I teach American studies, Latino studies, globalization, things like that.
And it's my goal in life to find a way to bring you to this faculty. And we've been working on this for a long time. Manuel and I just think your work is just so excellent. And we had the privilege of participating in a Lived Theology group that met in L.A., I guess. We met in New York a couple of times. And then you've been back at least once for SILT. So it's really nice reconnecting. Yeah. AJ.
Oh, it is okay. I thought it was the speakers. Okay. I'm AJ Walton. I just graduated from Duke Divinity last week. And I'm an incoming PhD student here at Virginia. Yeah,
Oh, Mary. have to say goodbye to your children.
I'm Deborah Lackey. I'm a PhD student here in the Scripture Interpretation and Practice Center. I'm Laura Alexander. I'm a senior year in the Theology of the Holy Spirit.
My name is Amy Martin. I actually work here locally with the Ron Ross Bell Program, and I'm a recent graduate of Princeton Theological Center.
Larry Perry, I'm just finishing my first year of my PhD here in New York.
Really, as well as in TEC, you've been here a little while.
No. But you're at the COP stage now.
Yeah, but we're coming along and interested in some work by Thurman, probably possibly at the intersection of the law and speed of the law.
Who did you say?
Howard Thurman.
Oh, Howard Thurman.
On Sunday.
I'm Shelley Coe. I'm also in the teaching program here in Postdoctoral Theology.
Chris?
Hi. Chris Norris. I just finished my first year of the PhD program here in Theology.
Yeah, that thing I said about the speakers going first, ignore that. Okay.
I'm David Dark, mostly a high school English teacher in my adult life, but recently finished a PhD at Vanderbilt in histories and critical theory.
And we're very excited to have you here. And David, you'll have to talk about your theological book on Radiohead at some point. Let's live theology. And you're very active in working on the project. And Kelly is the genius behind the Civil Rights Project that's going to be launched very soon. We'll talk more about that later in SILT.
I'm Jenny McBride, the Emory University Capacity Leader as a postdoc fellow and other things. And I'm moving to Waverly, Iowa in a couple months to work at Wartburg College.
Amazing. I know. You go on the market and you come away with a chair, endowed chair, you know. Your first job on the market. No one likes you, Jay. No, I'm just kidding. We're so proud of you. Jenny, your book is coming out with Oxford really soon.
December.
And it's going to be a hit. And you're going to talk more about your work tomorrow. Mm-hmm. No, we love you. We're so proud of you.
Mary McClellan Fulkerson. I've been at Duke 100,000 years.
Get out of here. Well, I'm glad you're teaching practical theology. It's really nice having you back, and this is such a terrific book. It's fun following it for, you know, a number of years and exchanging. Yeah, well, it's well worth the wait.
I'm Susan Dunlap. I teach classes in pastoral care at Duke Divinity School, and also work as a chaplain in a homeless shelter.
Fantastic. Living in Nashville, by the way. Nashville people.
My name is Matt Hedstrom. I have just finished my second year on the faculty here in religious studies and in the program in American studies. My training is in American studies. I'm really a historian of religion in the United States in the 19th.
And what's coming out soon? Your book is coming out pretty soon.
Yeah, it'll be in the next spring.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'll talk about that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. It's great having you, Matt. Yeah.
My name is Christina Garcia Wade. I've been sending some emails from Mary. I work as project manager for the project on the theology. I'd also like to take the time to announce that we have ordered decaf coffee, waters, iced tea, and sweet tea.
And the reason we're here and that this thing is happening is because of Christina's organizational genius, handling details from both coasts. It's just remarkable, the work you've done. And we'll be there tonight for dinner.
And the reason that Charles is here is because of Karen.
My name is John Keyes. Just finished a PhD in theology and ethics down at Duke, and just took a position at the Loyola University of Maryland teaching theology and ethics.
Fantastic.
I'm Mark Storsley. Just finished my second year of coursework here at the University of Virginia.
And I'm Tim Harmon. I'm beginning my third year in the PhD program here at the Theology
and Ethics. And you used to work for the project. It was fantastic.
Yeah, I was a GRA, a graduate research associate, for 2 years.
A year.
A year. Felt like 2 years. Yeah. And you really did some amazing work on, like, tracking down Dietrich Bonhoeffer's trip across America in 1930-31, reconstructing that with all these old maps and legends and photos. Yeah, you do much more than that, but I appreciated that. I appreciated that very much. Welcome home.
Thank you. Yeah. My name is Sarah Zanski. I'm also an alumna. I currently teach at the University of San Diego. And my book just came out last month. Yay! And next, I'm working on Howard Griffin, thinking about Benjamin May. So I'm excited to hear that.
Copies of your book are available at the amazing price of $30. We have 5 here, yeah, so if you want to buy one. I know some of you ask. Yeah. Just don't tell Cynthia that we're selling it for $30. That's right. That's so exciting. Yeah. Oh, well.
So I'm Philip Lorich. I'm a PhD student in ethics here, and I took over from Tim.
Yeah, you've been a GRA in the Project in Lit Theology for a year, and your work has involved a lot more theological research, for which I'm sure you're deeply grateful.
I am. I didn't have to deal with any math.
Yeah, that's right. The shirt looks really good on you, too, by the way.
Yeah. It has been working for the project as well and has been amazing in helping set up everything from name tags to folders to tables, so props.
So thank you. So thanks to all of you for being here. We're already running a few minutes behind. But to sort of move us into our work together this afternoon, I would like to respond to the question, does lit theology need a method, the question I posed in my subtitle, and to do so in, I think it's 6 parts, but it may be 5. The development and flow of my remarks will be seamless, and in the end, we will have achieved an encyclopedic knowledge of all the things lit theology needs and does not need. The 6 parts are as follows. A prolegomen to the study of lit theology, including a brief history of modern theology. The second section called Timing is Everything. The third section, Heidegger's Hut, a digression. Fourth section, Other People's Secrets, Faith, Hope, Love, and Treachery. Next session on the difference between lit theology and practical theology. And then the final section, Does lit theology have a method? So, a prolegomena to the study of lit theology, including a short history of the modern world. And I want to do this in 20 minutes, the whole paper. Where might we locate lit theology in the story of modern theology? I offer the following proposal. Lit theology explores aspects of human experience insufficiently examined in the canon of theological literature that begins with Kant's first critique and concludes in the Barth-Tillich impasse. These historical markers are not perfect, but bear with me because they help illustrate my point. In the Critique of Pure Reason, Immanuel Kant argued that the ideas of reason, God, world, and self cannot be known with certainty. The ideas of reason give order and coherence to moral life, the totality of the world, and the thinking I. But the ideas are best understood as the transcendental conditions of the possibility of experiential continuity. The ideas are unknowable but useful. In this manner, the pursuit of ever better schemes for reinterpreting the idea of God and the whole catalog of Christian doctrine becomes the central preoccupation of modern Protestant theology. The plot line of the story turns on this quest for the truthfulness of metaphysical reality when the doctrines and beliefs of the Christian faith can no longer be considered true. Knowledge of God might rather be based on a mode or modulation of human experience, moral order, beauty, sublimity, earth and blood, being towards death. Theological ideas are organizing tools, energies of thought and feeling that may prove beneficial, or they may not. One fine spring afternoon in this very room, 2 decades ago, my beloved teacher, Richard Rorty, in response to the then trendy deconstructionist theologian whose name I won't repeat, made this wonderful remark. Rorty said, Pascal earned himself a footnote in the theology books by distinguishing between the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and the God of the philosophers. Since Pascal's time, the former God has remained about the same, but the latter God has gotten weirder and weirder. Accepting for a moment the plausibility of Karl Barth's analysis that, this is a mouthful, the assimilation of the Christian gospel to a statement, a religion, a mode of self-awareness, enslaved the Christian to destructive patterns, forces, and movements, then the enterprise of lived theology cannot be a mere retrieval of the priority of experience or of practice. Barth's magisterial alternative to the 19th century restores much that was lost in the Protestant liberal tradition's ambitious projects. But what became of lived experience? Timing is everything. I'm not quite sure why this is titled that, because the paragraph in which that made sense has now been deleted. But in 1935, a suicidal Graham Greene hacked his way through brush and plague in a feverish trek across the Liberian interior. He had no better grasp of his intentions at the end than when he began. You can read about it in his book, A Journey Without Maps, a flawed, frustrating, cautionary tale for writers. The process may be, he seems to say, the only revelation. But sometimes the flaws and the fails are all the story you need. A few years after I began my teaching career, at a time when my research was focused on themes related to selfhood, theology and selfhood, I began to notice the recurrence of words and images in my notebooks that had little to do with the monograph on Trinitarian subjectivity, which I had thought I might write. These words and images pointed me away from that research and towards a set of questions that possessed a personal urgency, but also seemed unexamined theologically. The questions pertain to one of the most brutal periods of theological abuse in the history of Christianity. The decision to engage a range of experiences and material, outside the gates of academic theology, the whole teeming world of social and historical life, and to do so, I should add, as a theologian convinced he had not in fact abandoned his discipline, felt abrupt and dangerous, but born of urgency, as I said, and slight desperation, it could not be avoided. I had no knowledge of field research or oral history, and I could not tell you what I was hoping to accomplish. I had no method, but I did have questions, and these questions were theological. One of them had been posed by Martin Luther King Jr. of white Christians in the segregated South. Who is the God they worship? This is a question, in my estimation, King was never able to answer. And as it turned out, in any case, having the right questions, or at least being clear about what my questions were, created a framework within which on-the-ground decisions about resources, theories, and methodologies proved surprisingly uncomplicated. A set of vivid theological questions led me to places where answers seemed most likely to be found, if there were answers, and there were not always answers, to persons, to archives, to scratching around in people's attics, to standing in a field in a town square or alongside a dirt road, hoping that the atmospherics of place would offer lessons of their own, and always back on the road. This is not to say that the research always went smoothly. In one of the first interviews I conducted in the writing shack of a Southern minister named Will D. Campbell, I placed my microcassette recorder underneath a window air conditioning unit, and 4.5 hours of riveting conversation I discovered the next day had been drowned out by the sound of this mighty machine. My journey without maps was propelled not only by theological but by emotional and personal questions, as I have now said several times. But what I'm trying to say, though, here is that that the bow to self-respect, to the therapeutic, to a listening attunement to body and mind, indeed to all that makes you afraid and angry and all that makes you feel joyful and free, must surely be trusted as an able companion in this journey. My guess is that the critical reception to my efforts exemplifies the challenges that many of you had or will face in writing lived theology or something that may approximate that. The few professional reviewers who took notice were generous but didn't care much for the theology. Historians were mostly charitable, as were scholars of race and Southern culture. Sociologists and anthropologists appreciated the descriptive sections. My immediate professional colleagues, however, thought I had jumped ship, and soon enough the verdict was delivered. I was no longer theological. Heidegger's Hut, we're going to have to skip. Other People's Secrets, Faith, Hope, Love, and Treachery. Telling an honest story seems to be a difficult task for the Christian theologian. Telling an honest story casts a harsh light on our tendency to whip complexity into a homiletical froth. That's an awful line, but, you know, you get the picture. Telling an honest story is not an edifying discourse. It may strengthen faith, it may build hope, or it may cause huge problems. In her book, I Could Tell You Stories, Sojourns in the Landscape of Memory, the memoirist Patricia Hampel wrote, "The parallel lines of memory and imagination clash and collide finely in narrative. The casualty is the body of privacy laying smashed on the tracks." The memoirist, like the journalist, understands the art of treachery. You will betray your own mother if it gets you closer to the truth. "The journalist is always selling somebody out," wrote Dennis Covington in his great ethnographic study, Salvation on Sand Mountain, Snake Handling and Redemption in Southern Appalachia. The book is actually a completely insane memoir and fabulous. But I guess it's ethnographic, too. Well, theology has much to learn from these treacherous arts, in my opinion. Why should theology be held to different standards? Once in an interview, a kindly minister who had been recalling his years as a staff member of the National Council of Churches and role in the 1965 March on Selma paused and said, looking at me directly, "You know, your generation is a bunch of wimps." And then he continued in his gentlemanly way, talking about his years in the 1960s. So I asked myself, what kind of theological writing requires the courage of a sit-in, all right, for example, or a selective buying campaign or a freedom ride? I mean, the least I could do, being a wimp and all, was to try to tell an honest story. Following the drift, inkling your way through angry mobs and conflicting claims, running after leads, might we say this is what lived theology tries to do. There's no guidebook for this yet. Maybe we'll produce one. The traveler lives the journey idiosyncratically, taking on mountains, enduring deserts, marveling at the lush green places, Hampel again, moving through it all faithfully, not so much as an expert or a guide, as that older sort of traveler, the pilgrim, seeking, wondering. It would be my hope that lived theology helps clean religious language of its lies, self-deceptions, and willful naivete, my own language, above all. To be sure, any kind of writing may perpetuate falsehood, hence the importance of precision, honesty, and craft. Theologians and preachers bring so much wishful thinking into their promulgations and proclamations. If dogmatics works too hard to make experience accommodate its mandates, it would be my hope that lived theology makes artful and vivid our creaturely habitation in the uncertain middle, filing reports and dispatches along the way, letting the story unfold, trying to tell an honest story against the horizons of God. Bonhoeffer wrote in his journal, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, when he was pastoring in Barcelona in the late 1920s, this was just after his own encounter with the theology of Barth, which was decisive and deeply formative. But as he imbibed the Mediterranean culture and Spanish Catholicism, and under the what he called the nonstop assault of all these new impressions, he wrote in a journal and said, "I wonder whether Barth could have written in Spain. I wonder if Barth could have written the dogmatics on the Mediterranean, whether he had any understanding at all for circumstances outside Germanic culture." I don't know. I thought that was interesting. I'm occasionally asked the question, and we've moved now to the difference between lived theology and practical theology. I'm occasionally asked the question if lived theology is practical theology. I don't think it is, although I've never taken a course in practical theology, and I'm not sure. I would certainly take Mary's course, but I'm sure that had one been offered at Harvard Divinity School in the early 1980s when I was there, or in the religious studies department here a little later in that same horrible decade, I would not have taken it. Practical theology is an integrative hermeneutical endeavor at the heart of theological education, characterizing not only the ministerial subdisciplines, but also a manner and method of engaged reflection. This is the best definition I can offer, and it's not mine, of course. Credit goes to the American Society of Practical Theology, which I discovered on the internet a few days ago. I like the term engaged reflection. Not so much ministerial subdisciplines or the nightmarish integrative hermeneutical endeavor. But even the uplifting engaged reflection is not quite right, since lived theology must sometimes pull down the blinds and join the disengaged if it wants to get any writing done. I have not drawn on any model of practical theology, as far as I know, in conceptualizing and organizing the programs of the project. I've relied on collaborative work such as this, my questions, your questions, and A Journey Without Maps. The challenge of lived theology, as I've sort of pursued it, is to try to keep track of and to cleave to a number of considerations. A disciplined attention to the details of lived experience, an attention to the way theological commitments in their inner logic and integrity aspire towards and have an intentionality towards lived expression, and also to the question of theology as writing. This tends to come up a lot in our conversations. A shared sort of sense that theological writing needs to be, the question of theological writing needs to be revisited and given some new freedom. The last, this question of writing, which may raise questions about method or theory, I tend to think of as a question also about style. Let me explain. Early drafts of lived theology narratives, in my experience, and possibly in yours as well, include generous servings of theological analysis in the body of the work, breaks for second-order reflection on the unfolding story. But then the age-old struggle between showing and telling breaks out in the workroom. And you realize that soon enough that narrative interrupted by scholarly hiccups is not a pleasant sound, despite all the potential benefits of a good hiccup. You can then try placing the analytical material in the footnotes, but in most cases this won't work either because editors, publishers these days hate long footnotes. So you lumber on, trying hard to show, even though your conscience says tell, only to hear another frightening sound. That would be the slow and steady collapse of your theoretical scaffolding. And if you survive this ordeal and journey on, you will then, I think, and only then, watch the characters and the stories sparkle into life. We will have discovered what most writers of fiction know by second nature, that narrative untethered from theory runs over everything. So finally, does lived theology need a method? I'm not sure lived theology needs a method. I am quite certain that lived theology needs a theology. Falling into the cracks of the aging revelational correlational impasse, a theological immersion in the singularities of experience may illumine a way forward. Karl Barth, on whose side I tend to err and against whom I always struggle, restored vitality to theological realism by foregrounding in dogmatics the particular beliefs of Christian faith and unleashing the scriptures from their incarceration and historical critical gulags. Though they may be conceived as second-order reflection on the church's distinctive speech and practices, the church dogmatics, you've got to admit, preach. Well, if Barth gives us a multi-layered and rich theological realism, then perhaps we might think of lived theology as something like a theological hyper-realism in which the singularities of lived faith are foregrounded in narrative. A discourse related to but distinct from dogmatics that preserves the sheer phenomenality of experience, which can only be appreciated in the particular as such. Put rather more strongly, lived theology animates, or may animate, in narrative, experiences and questions that dogmatics ignores, evades, or distrust. So it is probably too soon to tell, to answer this question, to tell whether lived theology needs a method. It may even be too soon to tell whether lived theology has a method. My guess is that lived theology will inspire a multitude of methods, you know, depending on subject matter and all of that. These are some of the matters that I look forward to discussing with you over the next day and a half. So, thanks a lot.